Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures. For more than 50 years, the museum has told stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character. Details at texancultures.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. San Antonio officials reported Wednesday night that the number of confirmed coronavirus cases in Bexar County has jumped to 25. 111 people have tested negative for COVID-19. In total, Metro Health has processed 135 tests. Every day, we're seeing the number of coronavirus positives climb, pretty much double. That is not a good trend line. Meanwhile, the race is on for a vaccine, and many people are showing the stress of watching this pandemic. This is also, for many, a mental health emergency. We want you to join our conversation as we talk about these issues. What are your questions, and what are you dealing with out there? Call in. The number is 833-TPR-TALK, 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. You can also email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tweet at us at TPR Source. And our guest this hour, we're joined by Dr. Junda Wu, the medical director for the San Antonio Metropolitan Health District. Doctor, it's great to have you here in the studio.
Thanks.
Online, we're being joined by Joanne Turner, PhD, Vice President of Research at Texas Biomedical Institute. Joanne Turner, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us online, we're joined by James Bray, PhD, Professor of Psychology at the University of Texas at San Antonio. James Bray, good to have you.
Good to have you as well.
So, Dr. Wu, if you could tell us first off, how are things going right now? I mean, you must be working nonstop, right? I mean, pretty much.
We're all pitching in, and I couldn't be more proud of the health department at all levels. We've pulled everybody from immunizations to our phone bank. We're fielding hundreds of calls at that phone bank every day using that information to figure out where we need to fix things in our community or where we need to change our messaging. The messaging is probably one of the biggest challenges because everything's changing so fast.
So the messaging. Okay, we can help you with that.
Yes.
What message do you want people to know?
One of the things that I have started to notice recently is that some people are taking this very seriously and you know, being perhaps over anxious, and then other people are complacent in a way that worries me. We do need to take this seriously. I think there's the idea that is out there, I think, that 80% of people have no symptoms or very mild symptoms, and you know, the idea is out there that this mostly affects older people. So there might be other people who don't fall into any of those categories or who don't have underlying medical conditions who say, well, you know, it doesn't affect me. The part that I want people to realize is that for that 20% of people who could be infected, by the way, by one of those 80% because they don't know they have the infection, right? For that 20% of people, the hospitalization rate is very high. The ICU rate is very high. The ventilator use, I mean, is much higher than we'd expect. We do see some illness even in that 20 to 44 age group. The CDC put out a summary up to March 16th, and out of the people who were hospitalized, when you look at the ones in the ICU, about a quarter, let me look at my notes here, a quarter of the ones who are hospitalized end up in the ICU. So that's a higher number already than we usually see in general for hospitalizations. And then of people in the ICU, about 1 in 8 of them were in that 20 to 44 year age group. So this does affect all groups, and it's the trickle down effect that I don't know if people realize it. If the hospital system is overwhelmed, then that, like in Italy, like we're seeing, or like, you know, we saw in China, where they had ICU beds in the hallways in Italy, that means if you just need regular medical care, you know, if you have diabetes or asthma or you just need to deliver a baby.
Car wreck, those things still happen.
Yeah, those things still happen. So we can all do our part right now by staying home, by following these social distancing recommendations to try to decrease community spread, and hopefully we won't overwhelm the hospital system too much. That's the idea.
You mentioned Italy. We saw that Italy has become like the center. They're having a high number of fatalities there dealing with the coronavirus. And and people have looked at Italy saying that's where the United States could be in 14 days' time if the trend continues, looking at the numbers. And you made a face.
Well, we're going to see. So right now, the curve is a little affected by the fact that we just started testing. So it's very steep, right? Anytime you test more for something, you're going to see more positives. I think we'll have a good idea in 2 weeks' time whether we're going to be like Italy or not.
Sure. We can talk about testing in a bit because it certainly seemed like we're not testing adequately across the population. And the people who are allowed to have a test are people who have traveled and who are highly likely to have come in contact, right? There's some circumstances, like you have had contact with someone and other things, like, right?
Well, in San Antonio, Bexar County, we learned that we have a little bit of flexibility. Those are the national guidelines. That's exactly right. But actually, as of last week, and it is kind of blurring because we've been so busy, but I think since, I want to say Friday or Saturday, the local guidelines have been you don't have to have traveled to be eligible. Travel can definitely be a qualifier, but not having traveled does not exclude you, because we know that, you know, in California, in New York, besides those geographical areas where we already know there's a lot of coronavirus, there's no reason to suspect the novel coronavirus, just to be clear, not the regular coronavirus. There's no reason not to think we don't actually have it in the community, too.
Yeah, there's no reason to think that we don't have community spread here locally right now, correct?
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of when, not if.
And we do have these qualifiers in place in order for individuals to get a test. And you can be asymptomatic, not have any symptoms, and be infected and be a spreader.
You can.
And those people are not being tested.
Those people are not being tested for a lot of different reasons. Right now, the argument against testing people who don't have symptoms, besides the fact that we don't have enough tests, are that, well, how often are you going to keep testing somebody?
Right.
I mean, you could go into a whole bunch of scientific reasons that it doesn't
make
sense.
So we need to monitor. The number one thing is monitor the situation. You know, how bad is the infection? Is it community spread? Has it reached a high number of the percentage of the population? Those are the questions that really people really want answers to, and we can't get them until we can do widespread testing.
We can get some answers if we are able to test everybody who has symptoms, would be eligible for testing. Right now, I think there's a bottleneck even there.
Because we don't have enough tests, right?
We don't have enough tests. There are more coming. It's ramping up very quickly, but we don't have enough yet.
And but the point I was trying to get to initially is that Italy had a higher percentage or ratio of hospital beds to its population than the United States has right now.
Yeah, Italy's got a sophisticated healthcare system. New York City has a sophisticated healthcare system, and they're struggling right now.
And South Texas.
Well, yeah. I mean, and New York City is a little unique, too, because it's so close together, but we are worried. The good part is there is an organization called STRAC that has been working
a lot of coordinating here locally. I'm sorry to interrupt you right there,
You're fine.
I got to get to this break now and remind our listeners that our phone number is 833-877-8255. That's 833-TPR-TALK. We'll get to the rest of our guests as we talk about coronavirus, what's happening with the vaccine, and how this is also a mental health crisis for many here locally. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Coronavirus, again, the topic, because what else is there? This is severe, and it's changing every day. Right now, we're focusing on what's happening here locally with the Metropolitan Health, also what's going on with developing a vaccine, and also how to manage our fear and anxiety in this troubling time. Let me go over to Joanne Turner, Vice President of Research at Texas Biomedical Institute. Help us understand when we hear that it's going to be 12 months, 18 months, maybe till we get a vaccine, what is that? Is that fast, slow? What does that mean?
That's relatively fast. And I think it's important for people to know that there's abundant research going on in the scientific community, looking at ways to speed up getting therapeutics and vaccines and diagnostics. And so everybody in the scientific community is working really well together. But getting a vaccine out to humans can actually take one, most likely closer to 2 years, to get that vaccine actually out in the community. And so there's lots of steps that have to we have to go through. We have to develop a vaccine, which means scientists have to do basic research and develop something that works, and this is a new virus for us. And then we need to put it through testing to make sure it's safe in animal models, and that's currently the biggest roadblock for us. And any vaccines that have already made it through there, they have to go through safety trials. And then if they are safe, they have to go through manufacturing upscale so that we have enough to give out to the general population. And so there will be a lag time. And right now, one of our biggest roadblocks is where Texas Biomed are really playing a role is in developing a really robust animal model, as that will help us have a model that really replicates what we see in humans very well. And then we can actually test those vaccines and therapeutics in that model. It gives us a much better idea of how it would perform in humans. And if we go through a non-human primate model, then it gives us more chance to get them through to humans quicker.
Dwayne, help me, basic understanding here of vaccines from a guy off the street. And a vaccine is teaches your body to produce the antibodies so that when it is exposed to the live virus, that it's able to prevent being infected by it, right?
That's exactly correct. We're essentially fooling our body to think it's seen the real thing, but without that risk associated with it. And often those vaccines, we have other products with them to actually really kind of scare our immune system to respond really well to what isn't necessarily something that's dangerous to them. And we generate an immune response, and that's antibodies, and it can also be cells that can remember seeing that. And then if we encounter it again, our response is quicker, which means that if we have an infection, we can control it faster before we get symptoms.
And typically you use what, a dead version of the virus in a vaccine?
It can be a variety of different approaches. One approach is to use a dead virus that we would then use as that vaccine. Others are to use pieces of the virus. If we know which parts stimulate the immune system very well, then we can do that. Those are obviously safer and easier to manufacture because we can bulk manufacture those as little pieces of proteins. So there's lots of approaches that we can do. But yes, we can use dead vaccine. We can use an attenuated or an adapted live vaccine. Or we can use proteins or smaller peptides, which are pieces of protein, all to give that initial immune response that would be associated with a vaccine.
And so the challenges are, is growing that, whatever that is going to be, whether it's a part of that dead virus, or, you know, you have to be able to manufacture that or replicate that in mass so that it can be something that can be distributed to the billions of people that we have on this planet, I imagine.
That's correct, but we're initially at the stage where we're looking at a model where we can even test those newly developed vaccines to make sure that they're safe and effective against this new virus. And so that's really an important step for us, and there's scientists around really around the globe trying to work on that and working together to isolate the best model. So that might be a rodent model, such as a mouse, but it's most likely going to be a non-human primate. But we don't know which species of non-human primate yet, and so there's a lot of work going on to try and define which animal model we need that will define how we test that vaccine.
And so it could be, what, a baboon or a macaque or something along those lines that we have at Texas Biomedical Institute?
That's correct. Yeah. So we're actively doing studies using marmosets, macaques, and baboons. And other primate centers around the U.S. are also testing some of those other models. Baboons are unique to Texas Biomed. Any one of those three could be the best model for this virus. And then once we know that model, we'll all adapt and switch to that model to be able to use it to test vaccines. And for testing therapeutics is another approach that we can actually have.
There are people who don't like the fact that live non-human primates are used in this type of research.
That's absolutely correct. And I think most of the population always wishes that we didn't have to use an animal model, but it really is the best and most accurate way to really determine what's going to happen in humans. We have to make sure it's going to be safe to go into humans. We can't make something worse.
I think everyone wishes we didn't have to use non-human primates for this purpose, but there's really doesn't seem like there are any other choices.
There aren't many other choices. I think computer modeling is not really where it needs to be effective, to predict. And I think some of our smaller animal models, such as mice or guinea pigs, are great for a good first screen, but ultimately non-human primates are really that portal that we need to make sure that it's safe before we go into humans and effective.
So when we hear that a year, 18 months for this vaccine to be available to the public, how well do you feel about that? Do you feel that that's a good ballpark idea of where this is going to be?
I think that's fairly accurate. I wish it was sooner. We're obviously going as fast as we can to get a vaccine out there as quick as possible. The ultimate approach is to repurpose some drugs and therapeutics, and those are also being tested as well to see whether that's kind of a good stopgap so we could treat people and not necessarily prevent infection.
All right. I'm going to go on to our next guest, James Bray, professor of psychology at University of Texas at San Antonio. And Dr. Bray, do you think right now when I describe this as also as a mental health crisis, is that accurate or am I overstating it?
I think you're overstating it a bit. I think that the first thing to remember is that when you're faced with something like we're faced right now, feeling stressed, nervous, or a little anxious is absolutely normal, and we shouldn't make that a mental health problem per se. Certainly people can develop a mental health problem that needs professional help right now, but most people who are dealing with this are dealing with it effectively, and they just need to recognize that, you know, the feelings that they're having are pretty normal given the context that we're dealing with.
A lot of people are being told, don't go to work, stay at home. They're maybe losing their jobs or their spouse losing their job. All this uncertainty being broadcast to us all day long about what's happening with the coronavirus, possibility of if you already have a compromised immune system, then you're probably going to have to take extra precautions. People have a lot to feel anxious about.
They certainly do. And, you know, if you're in one of those situations you just mentioned, those are all things where you would get anxious or stressed or upset, because if you don't have a paycheck, you know, to pay the rent, certainly you're going to be upset about it. There's a difference between that, which is a normal reaction to a significant life stressor, and having a mental health disorder that needs professional intervention and treatment. We can do things to help ourselves that we can do without professional treatment, but it's certainly, if you feel like you need professional treatment, you should go get it sooner than later.
So the things I'm wondering about are people who are dealing with addictions. This is a tough time.
Absolutely. And this is certainly a case where if you are in recovery, it's essential that you go out and connect with your recovery community and connect with the resources that you have had in the past that have helped you stay clean and sober. That's one of the best things that you can do rather than turning and relapsing, which is going to create even more problems in your life.
In this time of social distancing, is that going to have to take some adaptation?
Certainly. And, you know, this is where, fortunately, in the era of smartphones and internet connectivity, we can actually have some kind of face-to-face kind of conversations with people. And people can stay connected. It's very important that you stay connected to people who are important in your life and talk to them about your concerns. That's for everybody. And everybody needs to be sure and do that, because when we self-isolate, we know that if you're just talking, you know, texting and not actually seeing human and having human contact, people do feel more lonely and get feel more anxious during that time.
All right, I'm going to go to our callers. Number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And Diane, thanks for holding on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, I have a question about a family gathering. It's my husband's birthday Saturday and our brother-in-law's tomorrow. The family would be about seven total. Two of the family members, three, work in the medical community. Should we do it? My husband will be. Well, he's 72. Hi, honey. I know you're listening. And he's a diabetic, and he has a couple other little issues. Should we do it? I don't want to be the one to tell him no or yes. I need advice.
All right. Dr. Junda Wu, Medical Director for the San Antonio Metropolitan Health District. What are some of the questions that they should consider before they decide whether or not they want to accept the risk?
Right. And that is one of the most common questions we're getting at our hotline, which, by the way, is 210-207-5779, because we could spend all the hour answering these kinds of hotline questions. Definitely your husband is in a category that where he should be self-quarantining to be safe. Now, that doesn't mean that people can't come and visit from a safe distance, right, from a six-foot distance. People who are sick should not be visiting. And ultimately, of course, you're going to take everything into consideration, as David was suggesting, and do what, you know, there are a balance of things to consider. But the safest thing for him is to keep his distance from visitors.
And why not pick another day? Why not decide you're going to do it in 6 months or something like that? Is that something could be people should be thinking about, like thinking a little flexible about these types of things? I mean, what's a birthday anyway? It could be any time.
Creative, I like to say. Yeah, you can, if you haven't been introduced to things like Skype, maybe this is a time to use online, you know, use your phones or something to say hi to your friends. We talked about the isolation, and we don't want people to become isolated. That is a real danger. So we do encourage people to go take a walk in the park or go check on a neighbor, you know, maybe leave them some food, even if you can't actually spend a bunch of time with them, and maybe, you know, text or call them.
So, Dr. Wu, people say it's just seven people who are going to be gathering together. But actually, it's not just seven people. It's all of the people that those people have come in contact with over the past maybe 10 days or so. It's not just me and you in a room together. It's everyone that I've been in contact with, right?
There's that. So the part of the reason the messaging is tricky is we don't also I don't know what's going to make people be overly, you know, panicky, anxious versus just sensible. We want people to take sensible precautions. It's important to know that we don't think that there's significant transmission by people who don't have symptoms. So, you know, the most important thing is not having visitors who are sick, keeping your distance, washing your hands frequently, not touching your face. All of those things are very protective.
But we have seen that you can be have no symptoms and still be infecting others, right?
That we don't know. I'll just be honest and say we don't know enough. So this is called SARS coronavirus 2, if you want to, that's its technical name. And there was a SARS outbreak in Toronto more than a decade ago where there really wasn't any transmission that was asymptomatic when you drilled down. The cases that people have talked about with this novel coronavirus, when you look at it, it turns out that maybe people actually were, well, when you ask the people, they did have some symptoms, but the symptoms were so mild they didn't
realize it.
Right,
it's the sniffles and things like that.
Right, right. So even if you have sniffles, stay away. They could be really mild symptoms. If you have no symptoms, we don't know how infectious you actually are.
All right, we're taking a break. Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We're continuing the conversation, talking about the coronavirus and also how is it impacting you? And do you feel a lot of anxiety of what's happening? How are you managing that? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're taking your questions about the coronavirus, also talking about where we are with a vaccine. San Antonio was playing a major role in developing the vaccine at the Texas Biomedical Institute and using our best friends on this planet, which are the non-human primates, and how they're being treated, how they're being used in a way to help make sure the vaccine is going to be safe for everyone when we finally get it. Also, how this is impacting people's mental health as well. A lot of anxiety. How do we make sure this is an appropriate level of anxiety? What happens when you feel kind of out of control with that? Who can you reach out to? First, we got a lot of questions and voicemails. This is a voicemail from Vicky.
Hi, David. My name is Vicky Lucero. I live here in San Antonio. I'm not hearing anything about directive for the 5 million uninsured people in Texas. I mean, where, you know, if you have to have a doctor's note to get a test, where, you know, and you've lost your job and you don't have the money to go to the doctor, where's the directive for them? You know, they need to get tested. They need to have health care. And I'm not seeing anything in the media. I'm not seeing anything in the even in the TPR blog. And I even put a comment in there on the bottom. And you know, there are 4 million Texans who have no paid sick leave. Where's the directive, you know, for them? And also, you know, the homeless population in Texas. What is the directive for them to you know, to get help as well?
All right. Vicky, thank you for that great call. She brings up a lot of great points. I do want to point out, talking about the homeless population and the vulnerable population, is there's a very good reason why we should consider those, because we don't want to have a well where the virus can continue to exist and reinfect, and then we think we beat it and it pops up again. We find a way to treat it. We want everyone to be treated. And Dr. Junda Wu, what's your reaction to the call?
The homeless population has been on our mind from the beginning, and the health equity issues, right? Who has paid sick leave? Who can afford to study from home or telecommute? That's real. And we're probably going to see some widenings, but we've been doing our best. So let me just talk about homelessness and also how you can get tested if you don't have health insurance. One of the concerns is, of course, the courtyard at Haven for Hope. And so we have been working to find them an extra space so that at night, half the people can go to an extra space, and then the people in the courtyard can spread out a little so you get that social distancing. And we're also working with different groups that serve vulnerable populations, because as that is the core of what we do in public health, is to serve the vulnerable and decrease those health inequities. For people who don't have health insurance, the mobile testing actually, if you call the hotline at 210-207-5779, you will get put on a list. Somebody will call you back. We have some wonderful UT Health residents who are working on that in collaboration with STRAC, and they will screen you and see if you're eligible for the testing.
All right. We have an email from Jay. It says, I came across an article saying people are putting up Christmas lights to cheer each other up during this shutdown. So I put up my Christmas tree. I got my kids involved, and it really brightened our evening last night. James Bray, professor of psychology, University of Texas at San Antonio. Do things like this, does it make a difference?
Oh, absolutely. And what your caller is talking about is taking action on things you can do rather than just sitting around and worrying about things you can't do. So if you can take productive action and take action where you have positive experiences with your family members, friends, those are things that will help reduce your stress and help you feel more normal. And that's a great example of one of those things. There was on the internet about how in Italy, where people went to their windows and started singing, and that was a way to stay connected, and it brightens people's day. So that's a really important thing to do. There's several other things you can do as well.
Give us some examples.
So another is to be sure and practice good self-care. So if you're feeling nervous or anxious, do some relaxation exercises. There's all kinds of free ones on the internet. You can download them and listen to them. Or if you're do meditation, or if you're a spiritual person, pray. In addition, doing aerobic exercise, where you get your heart rate up will help you reduce your stress, and it actually is an evidence-based intervention for anxiety. So practicing good self-care, making sure that you do that kind of exercise is very important.
And we have another voicemail from Rafael.
Well, good morning. My name is Rafael Martin, and I'm calling, and my question is, since they're telling us to remain at home, if we have symptoms of the virus, that's pretty much all they're telling us to do. My question is, what is there available for us to do at home if we have signs and we don't have time to get to a medical facility and see a doctor?
All right, Dr. Junda Wu, what do people do if they start having the symptoms, which would be what?
So a fever, cough, shortness of breath, typically not a runny nose. That's not usually a symptom. So that's one way to help figure out, hey, are these allergies or do I need to be more worried? So do what you would do with if you had a cold, which is, you know, most people don't go see somebody for a cold. They just stay home and take care of themselves. You know, what if you have a fever, take Tylenol. If you've got a sore throat, take some sore throat medicine. And this is a really important point, so I'm glad that we heard that call, because we are urging people who have only mild symptoms to just stay home because we don't have enough tests. We need to save the tests for people who have moderate or severe symptoms. And we also need to save that personal protective equipment, the PPE, like the masks. I wanted to make a plea, if anybody has been hoarding masks, to please give them to medical, to clinics, because I'm hearing every day from regular providers. The hospitals are decently situated, although they're, you know, having to, unfortunately, to reuse or do extended use of the N95s as well. This is real. We are low on supplies. I got an email from somebody who said, we don't have hospital gowns. Could we use the little jackets? Which the answer is no. But there are physicians in the community who are seeing just person after person with, you know, upper respiratory symptoms who have not even a mask. If you have any that you've been hoarding, please give it to a clinic.
And the ibuprofen is something that's becomes popped up. Ibuprofen as like not used, should not be used.
I happened fortuitously to listen to a podcast with Dr. Anthony Fauci of NIAID last night, and he says there's no basis for that. I admit I haven't done all the research, but I trust him.
Okay, and let's go to another caller. This is Anna, and Anna, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I was just curious to know if anyone is aware if people who are asymptomatic or show no symptoms, if they would at some point, if there were tests available, would it show that they had the virus at some point, even if they did not exhibit extreme symptoms or have the full-blown ramifications of the virus?
Okay, so like if you get a TB test, right, it shows you've had TB, at least you had it, but you may be cured of it. But so is it, can it be like that, right? Like it showed that you did have it, but you no longer have it.
That would probably be a blood test, which we, right now, what we're using is a swab that wouldn't have that answer.
Okay, so the answer is no, it only shows you if you have it currently.
Correct.
Now, there's some concern about vaping. Now, if you have been vaping, does that put you in the high risk category?
In the sense that you might have your lungs that are weaker, right? Anybody with an underlying medical condition, I think, yeah. Any immune system problem, people who have high blood pressure, which is sort of interesting because usually high blood pressure is not not bad, especially if it's well controlled, but that seems to be something that a lot of people have in common who get very sick with this.
And a question from Twitter, is it safe to go to the parks since the gyms are closed? Can I run outside?
Absolutely. Take advantage of our wonderful park system here in San Antonio.
And an email from Denise. I would love to hear more healthcare professionals talk about keeping our immune system strong. I hear vague advice from like eat healthy and exercise. Is there anything more that people can do to boost their immune system?
I'm just going to stick with, well, get enough sleep, just that's like, eat healthy, exercise. Yeah, I know it is vague, but that's a whole other broadcast.
Right. But when you say, I mean, get enough sleep.
Yes.
To help protect your immune system. And we have doctors and nurses, other first responders like yourself, you're not getting, probably not getting enough sleep.
Yeah, nobody at Metro Health is getting a lot of sleep these days, admittedly. We have set up a schedule so that we can each get at least shorter days, hopefully days off every third or fourth day. So we'll try.
And James Bray, with a professor of psychology, UTSA, sleep, do you think people are losing sleep as well just by from the anxiety here?
They certainly can, and that's one of the things to do a self-check in, and if anxiety is getting to the point where you might need some professional help. So there's two things to check in for yourself. One is, are you having trouble getting to sleep because you can't turn your thoughts off? And normally it takes somewhere between 5 and 20 minutes to get to sleep. If you're laying there and not able to get to sleep for over 45 minutes to several hours, then that's a sign that you might actually be developing anxiety that you need some professional help with. And then the other thing is, how irritable are you? Often we're not aware of how irritable we are, so check in with your family and friends and ask them, are you know, you're more irritable lately? And those two things are signs that you might need to be taking more strong action to deal with this stress and anxiety. Another thing you can do to build your immune system is to do relaxation and meditation. There's clear scientific evidence for this. And the same thing about aerobic exercise, if you can do that. And that might just mean fast walking, or it may be more intense exercise. But those three things can really help.
Taking another break, you're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. Got a question or a comment about the COVID-19? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about coronavirus and also how you at home, you might feel a bit of anxiety. You may be losing a little sleep over this. Is that bad? You know, do you need some extra help? Who can you turn to? So James Bray, professor of psychology, University of Texas at San Antonio. If I start feeling myself or someone else in the household, now that we're all kind of stuck in there together, may need some help, may need to talk to somebody. Is there, are there people online that I can kind of get in touch with who could help us through this?
Yeah, so the good news is that because of the declaration of a national emergency and the governor's declaration, mental health professionals now can do telehealth. So you don't actually have to go into somebody's office to get the help, and your insurance is most likely going to cover the visit. So I know in the mental health community, I'm seeing people learning how to do this so that they can see their clients and patients without having them to come into the office. And so most mental health professionals I'm aware of are moving to this opportunity. So you may be doing FaceTime with your psychologist or mental health provider. Physicians are doing the same thing, so you might, you know, have a FaceTime meeting with them or, you know, Google Hangout or something like that, and that's all being covered now because of these declarations. The other thing for people who don't have insurance is they're expanding Medicaid coverage so that people who don't have health insurance because of their jobs, there's more opportunity there. And then there's also resources here in the San Antonio area that treats people without insurance.
A lot of people kind of in-house together. Everybody's, you know, maybe some people in the house don't always stay at home a whole lot. Now they're all stuck in the house together. Should we have a conversation? Say, okay, let's set some clear boundaries over, you know, how we're going to do things around here.
Yeah, that's an excellent idea. And then also you can take breaks. So the physician who talked about going outside and walking in the park, you can take breaks if you have your kids at home because you're having to do homeschooling now. Be sure that you kind of break that opportunity, those times up, so that people can still do their job, but also they can take care of their kids at the same time.
I'm spending a lot more time in the garden, so we'll have lots of tomatoes
Yeah, that's fantastic. And then they're probably healthy and you'll feel better.
Right. And I'll have some and other people won't. Let's go to an email from Dan. Where are we on sick leave? The ordinance was blocked by business groups locally in 2019. Is that going to have an effect on this coronavirus emergency? Dr. Junda Wu, I know that the San Antonio Metropolitan Health District was very much in favor of having a sick leave ordinance passed.
We are in favor of a sick leave ordinance, and we've been talking about that when we talk about coronavirus. But I don't know that there's going to be any movement on the local ordinance. It does seem like nationally something happened or is happening, right? And I'm not the expert on that.
Right, yeah. But San Antonio did finally get around to issuing the order. The mayor, Ron Nirenberg, said last call at the bars and restaurants in San Antonio for what, the next 30 days or so, if it gets passed by the city council, but he passed. Why is that a good thing, Dr. Wu, saying bars and restaurants, you're going to have to shut down?
It, again, just has to do with the social distancing and are people able to stay about 6 feet away from each other. Typically, not what we see in the bars and restaurants. In bars and restaurants, we also often have people who don't have any choice but to go to work sick. So that's another vector there.
So we're still trying to limit the spread of coronavirus in the community. So by taking away the option of hanging out in a bar or going to a fancy restaurant with a lot of other people and interacting with all sorts of folks, you are putting a dead end, hopefully, on where that coronavirus can go. And that will, as we say, flatten the curve, you know, so we don't have that huge spike of people who suddenly need medical care and we overwhelm our healthcare system. We don't have the beds. We don't have the respirators. If we can slow this down, the better off we'll be.
Right. If a lot of people are infected, then even if only a small number of people end up needing ICU care, then that's still more than the number that we have.
All right, let me go to back to the phones with Penny. And Penny, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, this is a comment more than a question. I'm getting rather anxious about the hoarding situation and the lack of food that is not at HEB these days. My family is actually situated okay because we had enough in our stores. But I'm concerned about people who can't get to HEB between 8 and 8, people who have limited transportation and can only get there intermittently. What exactly are people supposed to do about food?
All right. So when you said people who can't get between 8 and 8 to the HEB, Dr. Wu raised her hand because you're working all the time.
Yeah.
And so you haven't been able to go to the store. And when you do, it probably takes five times longer than it normally would.
I literally have not been to the grocery store since all of this started. I might end up asking a friend to go to the grocery store for me. Yeah.
That'd be a great friend.
Yeah.
We did that for you, or for all of us, because we want you to have everything you need. But so, James Bray, you're a professor of psychology. The psychology of scarcity and this panic type situation, does it tend to run its course, or what are you seeing here?
So, when we feel that way, we're beginning to kind of get into survival mode. And when we get into survival mode, that invokes oftentimes feelings of stress and nervousness. And the thing, again, to do is to continue to try and take appropriate action. The other day, I realized I needed some supplies, and I had to go to three different places. And I remember going to the second one, I began to feel a little anxious about, you know, am I going to be able to get what I need? And then I decided, well, I'm going to go to another one. And there it was. I got some of what I needed, and then the next day I had to go again. For people who can't go, there are other options. They're delivering. Amazon's delivering. Other places are delivering for you, and you can, you know, sign up for those actions. In some cases, there's no delivery charges. So, again, it's a matter of when you hit that first one and you don't find it, remind yourself that, hey, you know, maybe I have to go to a second or a third one and begin to look at alternatives rather than just HEB. There's many other places that you can get food products around San Antonio. And it's a time to check those things out and go there. And oftentimes some of these smaller places have a lot more things that you can purchase.
And Dr. Bray, it seemed like talking about panics at the supermarket doesn't seem to calm anyone down. Actually, it seems to get everyone sort of amped up and increases the panic.
It does. And so, you know, that's where it's important to engage in some different kind of self-talk. So rather than beginning to think of, oh, my gosh, what's going to happen? Am I going to have anything to eat? Realize that you can probably go down the street. You can certainly, if you can afford it, order from takeout in restaurants and just begin to think about things that you can, in fact, do to get what you need to survive.
Dr. Joanne Turner, Vice President of Research at Texas Biomedical Institute, with this race to get the vaccine developed, have we done this before? Is this something new? Do we have a history of being able to find these solutions when need presents itself?
Yeah, historically, this has happened before, sometimes with a different magnitude. The scientific community is very good at rallying together in a crisis and really putting together their brain power, coming up with a solution to an infectious disease problem. There's been lots of situations in the past where that's happened. And I think when people think about living through a crisis such as this, I think HIV initially was something that we can parallel with quite a lot. There was a lot of early panic, a lot of discomfort around it until we understood the facts. And so that we have to go to the lab and understand the facts about transmission, when we're infectious, how we cure it, and all of that is something that we're used to doing in science. We'd love to have more funding to be able to do that properly, and that's been a challenge for us in the last 10 or so years. But yes, we're ready to do this.
And the funding has a terrible way of we have a crisis, here's all this money, we get through the crisis, and then the money dries up. That doesn't seem to be a good pattern.
No, it would be nice if that could be more sustainable, because what happens is that scientists will be working on the next big problem earlier, right? They may think a virus is intriguing and study it and know a lot more about it if they've had the funding to do that. And then when it becomes a public health issue, we already have a lot of information. That's the piece that's lacking. The budgets have been cut for federal funding to a substantial amount, that we often don't have that discovery science happening, and that's preventing us having that little kind of advantage early on.
It helps to have pro-science people in government leadership.
It does help, yeah.
Let's go to Bruce on the phones. Hey, Bruce, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. My question has to do with advice for the elderly who are self-isolating and who begin to have serious symptoms. The advice that I seem to hear over the course of the last couple of weeks is more obvious types of things, washing your hands, self-isolating, and so forth. But in San Antonio specifically, if an elderly person, in my case 70 years old, begins to have acute symptoms, difficulty breathing, at that point, oh, what does one do? And I did see my family physician last week, and he said that he has no earthly idea. Call Metropolitan Health District.
I do have to get in this breaking news. It just came out that Governor Abbott has issued a statewide executive order closing bars and restaurants. Schools are being shuttered. He's doing this statewide. This has all been happening on a very local basis. Now it's across Texas. Limiting visits to nursing homes. Drive-through and pickup services is allowed at grocery stores are remaining open. But Governor Abbott is stressing this is not a shelter-in-place order. This is something that Governor Abbott just issued right now. It's breaking news. And suddenly now when it's not just a San Antonio order to shut bars and restaurants, it is now statewide. So even little local cities and across the county, all those bars and restaurants have got to close. And I want to thank all of our guests. I'm sorry we could not get to your question on that, but I had to break the news to get on. And Dr. Junda Wu, the medical director for San Antonio Metropolitan Health District, thanks so much for coming in. Joanne Turner, vice president of research at Texas Biomedical Institute, and James Bray, professor of psychology at the University of Texas at San Antonio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Ken Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.